Every day, millions of men go to work questioning their purpose and how to leverage their gifts for the advancement of God's kingdom. Join us as we hear stories from other men just like you and me who have discovered the answer and are willing to share some wisdom they've learned along the way. Gathering wisdom is like dropping pennies in a jar. Over time, our jars fill up and overflow into the lives of others. Welcome to The Drop. Every day, millions of men go to work questioning their purpose and how to leverage their gifts for the advancement of God's kingdom. Join us as we hear stories from other men just like you and me who have discovered the answer and are willing to share some wisdom they've learned along the way. Gathering wisdom is like dropping pennies in a jar. Over time, our jars fill up and overflow into the lives of others. Welcome to The Drop.
Welcome to The Drop. My name is Michael Pick, and we're here today with Travis Avalow, who's had quite a varied path to get here. So I'm really excited to talk about his history, what wisdom he's brought. But also I want to, on the front end, acknowledge that he was a part of putting this whole Drop together. He's kind of been a creative influence and a producer. So I appreciate you taking the time to now be on the other side of it.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. So, hey, Travis, why don't you start out with just tell us about your family a little bit.
Yeah, I've been married to my wife, Jen, for 18 years. We've got two kids, London, who's 15, Stella, who's 11, and yeah, high school and close to junior high age.
All right. Yeah. Busy times.
Yeah. Okay. Super busy.
And are you originally from the Central Coast?
No, I'm from Coalinga, California, which is a couple hours east of here, small town. When I was growing up, it's like 12,000 people. You're an hour away from buying underwear or anything. There's just nothing okay. around.
Why did that come to mind?
I don't know, because like, maybe yeah. I need a lot of underwear. Okay. I don't know. But yeah, okay. Just like middle of nowhere.
All right.
My dad worked in like the oil distribution industry. And so it's like a good place for that. And so, yeah, he grew up there. Okay. So yeah, that's where I spent 17 years of my life and then came here for college and never okay. left.
All right. So tell me a little bit about, or tell us a little bit about what that background was like in Coalinga with your father,
yeah.
working in the oil business and faith. What kind of journey did you have that way?
Yeah. So it's really interesting. I grew up in a Baptist church. My parents got saved when I was little. There was a couple, Pam and John Johns, that were going to the Baptist church and they were just going door to door, knocking on doors and telling people about Jesus. And they came to my parents' door and shared the gospel with them. And my parents got saved and kind of, you know, it felt like as a family, we were all learning about faith at the same time,
wow.
you know? So they were kind of learning and jumped into a Bible study that they hosted and a friends group that they had, I think on Friday nights. And so we just kind of dove in and we quickly became the family that was like at church on Wednesdays, home group on Fridays, church on Sundays, all that kind of stuff, Awanas. And so it was a really good, informative experience for me, like just growing up in that church. And it was super, focused on the Bible, learned about all the biblical stories. So I felt like it was a really good upbringing in faith. When I came to college, I think part of it, like that we, I think a lot of young people kind of deal with is you kind of have these like, 2D stories about the Bible. Like you had like felt boards. You have felt boards when you're growing
yes.
up. Like, so you had like a little mm-hmm. 2D Peter walking on the water and 2D Jesus coming up. And so, and you know, you heard about all these kind of stories and I call it like flannel board theology. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, it's just kind of, you hear about these stories about these like biblical heroes, but then you realize like when you actually read the Bible, like they're not actually heroes at all. They're super deeply flawed. Mm-hmm. And I never made that connection. And I felt like that's the bit that I would have loved hearing about more is like the human element of these biblical stories. And so I had a great experience. It was a great church. I just felt like, you know, like so many kids, like I wasn't prepared for the real world, you know? And so that was something I had to learn quickly.
So let me ask you, I want yeah. to get back to your development when you moved to the Central Coast to go to college, but this kind of paradigm shift from flannel board theology
yeah.
to the flawed characters
yeah.
and people of the Bible, what was the epiphany that brought that to your attention?
I think it was just reading the Bible, honestly, like, you know, I you learn like memory verses, or like you have this like bumper sticker grab bag kind of Christianity. A lot of people, it's like, you know, the memory, you like you read Jeremiah 29:11, but not like verses 1 through 10, you know, or the, so it's like, sure. I had that same thing. It's like you hear bits and pieces of the biblical story, but you know, once I came to college, like went off the rails for a while, and then ended up going to Campus Crusade for Christ and walked into a room of a massive gathering. It was like 1,200 people or something like that. And none of their parents were making them go. And I just walking into the room, I remember Joel Limpick was leading worship. And I just remember thinking, whatever this is, I want as much of it as I can get. It just felt real and authentic. And I was like, this is what I wanted. You know, for some reason, I never really related to church as a kid. It just felt like I wanted to draw in the pew, you know, pay attention to the things kids
play
do.
Tic-tac-toe.
Exactly. Yeah. That kind of stuff. It just, I couldn't connect with it very much.
Okay.
And so coming to college, just seeing that, and then, you know, diving into reading, actually reading the Bible for myself and realizing like, oh my gosh, these people are awful. They're like me, you know? And so that just made it so much more relevant for me.
So a moment ago, you said you went off the rails a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So you feel comfortable talking about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, got to Cal Poly in the summer, and you know, just wanted to you know, you're just free, you feel like you're free, you know. It's like, oh my gosh, my parents, like, I don't have to go to bed anytime.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can drink as much beer as I wanted. Uh-huh. And so one night in particular, it got pretty hairy. And I remember just like waking up outside of a dorm room. Just
not yours,
not mine. Right. It was like a frat house or something like that. Just like throw up all over me, just walk of shame. Just like, what happened? Mm-hmm. Just slept for 2 days in my dorm room, and just like, it didn't take long. It took like one big night like that to realize this is not what I want. You know, it's like, it's not all it's cracked up to be. Mm-hmm. And so I just decided like, this is not who I want to be or the kind of lifestyle that is sustainable or that I want. Yeah. And so then one of my roommates was going to Campus Crusade and he invited me to go. And I thought, well, might as well, I'll go. And that's when I kind of realized
that. How old were you when that happened?
I just turned 18.
Okay. So
I came
really
to college
young.
When I was 17.
Okay.
Just about to turn 18, I think. And so I was like, oh, so young.
Okay. So what is Campus Crusade?
Well, it's now Crew.
Okay.
At the time, it was Campus Crusade for Christ. It was a gathering of college-age kids led by, I mean, adults, but like, you know, staffers. Jamie Pappas is still involved, and Joe Priola and a bunch of other great people were involved at the time. And we would go. We'd have Bible studies during the week. Eventually, I started going there in the fall, and the next summer got invited to lead worship for the summer. And the summer, like, everyone leaves, and so it's a lot smaller gathering. Mm-hmm. And I got asked to lead worship, and I'd never led worship in my life. And I asked one of the, I said, why me? And she said, well, I don't know, we have your name on this list, and you're the top of the list. Like, we'd love you to do it. Like, well, I've never led worship before. And I'd played guitar.
Did you put yourself on that list?
No, I still to this day have no idea how I ended up on this list. It was so wild. And so just kind of like, I remember looking at Joel and Jason Weatherhead and these guys who were leading worship and just thinking, man, that would be to lead people in worship like that would be amazing. And I remember driving, I remember when I was in high school with my mom, it's like years back, I was like singing along to the radio and I asked my mom, hey, do I have a good voice? What do you think? She's like, well, you should probably practice. Like, ooh, ouch, mom.
Not what I want to hear.
Mom, you know?
Yeah, don't you love me?
I know. Yeah. So at least that's my memory of it. Uh-huh. So she probably has a totally different memory. But then, so I thought when it came time to like lead worship for Campus Crusade, I was like, I can't lead. My mom doesn't even think I have a good voice. How am I going to do this? And I just in faith said, I'll do it. I just wanted to so badly. I thought it was the coolest thing. Yeah. And so did that through the summer. It was probably brutal for people as I just kind of like got my feet underneath me in leading worship. And then ended up doing a record with Campus Crusade the next year and other great worship leaders. It was so much fun, so formative. It was an amazing experience.
And that's continued for you. Your expression of faith through music.
Totally. Yeah, I realized kind of, you know, whether it's leading worship or writing or whatever it is, like you know, it took me till I was 35 to be able to articulate this in any meaningful way or understandable way. But I love just having conversations with the church. Like, not that I come with answers at all, but I hope to ask the right questions. And so this, like, I really believe in the church, and I believe that, like, in the bride of Christ, and that she's beautiful, but she, so yeah, just whether it's music or writing or podcasting or whatever it is, just this communication is the thing that I love. And you can do that through worship as much as any other medium. And so that's just the thing that I love doing.
So I don't want to forget to ask you this later, but so has part of your journey, that special night when you went to crew that first night, been trying to recreate that for others? That moment?
Maybe not consciously, but that's, you know, I think what it was is just like the Holy Spirit's in the room, and you know, I think as a worship leader, you're just trying to position yourself in such a way as to not get in the way. And really just worship and pray that, I mean, the Holy Spirit's obviously in the room. And so it's just like, let's create an atmosphere where, and I think the thing that makes the difference is hunger. Like, there's no substitute for hunger. When a bunch of people, whether they're college students or high school, junior high, or grown, like, adults, when they get in a room and they're hungry, they come expectant that the Holy Spirit's going to move. There's no substitute for that. And like, as a worship leader, that's the best, because then you're just like, we're all in it together. And when you're trying to muster up some kind of a feeling or like experience, it just never goes well, and you feels just gross.
Okay.
So you try not to do that, but I just think, like, you're just trying to encourage people to, like, Lord's here, like, let's worship, he's worth it. And so
how do you do that?
I don't know. I've been trying to figure that out for like 20 years.
All right.
I think part of it is like, if I just come expectant and hungry and try to lead well and kind of bring people along the journey. I mean, we talk about it a lot at New Life, that we live in the 9th most post-Christian area of the United States. So I think sometimes we assume that people come in with, like, I grew up in the church, but in an area like this, most people probably didn't. And so I think part of it is, as a worship leader, it's like a lot of teaching and helping people connect the dots. Like, why are we doing this? I remember one pastor who'd been in the church forever. We would have these spontaneous moments where we would just, you know, sing whatever was on our heart to whatever music we were playing. And he asked, like, when you guys do that, what are you actually doing? Like, why are you doing that? And it was so normal for me, but for a person from another generation or another background, it was completely out of left field. And so it's like, oh, when we do this, like, here's what's happening. And so I think a lot of it's just like teaching and training.
So for interviewing you today, I'm going to kind of go ahead and maybe work backwards a little bit. And so this topic of worship, I think, is really important. You know, I have two sons or three sons, but two teenagers. And oftentimes at worship, it's just wooden and dull. Yeah. And how do you, as a worship leader, define what worship is and define why it's important for everybody, including younger people?
Yeah, it's really tough because, you know, when I was younger, I think at the time, I would say it felt hollow, maybe too, but I just think like the Lord was doing something in my heart. You know, it's kind of like osmosis. You're just like, you're in it. And hopefully now on the other side of it as an adult, you know, it's like, I want to model the kind of worship that I want my son and daughter to experience themselves. You know, and so I think with worship, it's like when you look through the Old Testament, there's 7 Hebrew words for praise, and every single one of them is a physical response, whether it's kneeling or raising your hands or singing or shouting or whatever it is. And it's not to say that, like, you can't just in your own heart and mind be worshiping without a physical response. I think that's totally fair game. But I think worship is just giving God worth. You're saying, like, this is who you are. This is what you've done in my life. And this is, you're deserving of praise, whether things are up and to the right or like really bad, you're just worth it. And so I think that can be through music. It can be through just like, just telling God who he is, anything like that. So, yeah, and for kids, I don't know. I think about that a lot with our young people. It's like, how do you engage them in worship, and is that even the goal? I don't know.
Okay.
I, I should know more. I should have a better answer.
That's a fine answer. Yeah. I'm just wondering, you know, where do you see the place for worship? What pillar or what need does that satisfy in us when we go to church every Sunday, whether we recognize it or not?
Yeah. I think there's something about, like, you know, worship isn't just the corporate gathering, obviously, right, like on Sunday mornings or whenever your fellowship gathers, but there's something about a bunch of people coming together, and I think we said this last weekend, like reminding each other of the faithfulness of God and reminding each other about the truths and why we believe what we believe. And so I think that's hugely important because, you know, when you're like so focused in on your own life and your own problems, you know, doubts creep up, which are fine. They're real. And you can sort of, I think you can get in your own head a little bit, but then when you go to church and you hear testimony of people who have, you know, gone through something really difficult and like God's remained faithful and they're talking about the faithfulness or you're singing about it in those words, it's like all through the Psalms, it's like you're commanding your soul to worship. It's mm-hmm. like, I think half the time you're kind of singing the songs, not trying to convince yourself that they're true, but sort of in a way it's like, oh yeah, that's right. He is faithful no matter what my like emotions or my life might be telling me. Yeah. He's faithful nonetheless. And so it's just like this corporate gathering is so important that like, and there's like a rich history of like thousands of years before me of like where God has just proven himself faithful to his people time and time again. And so no matter what I'm going through, I can look around the room and say like God's working in their lives in ways that, you know, I can't even imagine. And so it's just cool to remind each other of those truths.
That's a good answer. Thank you. So you get involved with Crew, you're in college. What happens next?
What happens next? Well,
like it's that simple and linear.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I was studying philosophy, which because you had to declare a major, you know, at 17, I have no idea what I wanted to do, but I was reading Kierkegaard and C.S. Lewis and all these guys thought I was smart. I was interested in like, why do people believe and think the way they do? Mm-hmm. But then I realized, well, I don't want to teach. I'm not sure what I want to do. So I think I'll just pause on the school thing until I know what I want to do. Well, in the meantime, I'd started working. I'd been working at a surf shop in Morro Bay. And then I meet my wife. And so that sort of takes my life in a whole different direction. So I was leading worship at Calvary Chapel in San Luis, their college group. And that's where Jen and I met each other. And so we ended up getting married. And so I started on a career path at that point and kind of leading worship on the side. So
what was your initial career path?
Initially got into retail sales and then marketing and then started doing outside sales for a medical company when our son was like a year old. I was working in marketing and, you know, it's just so hard to live on the Central Coast that it just came to the point where it was like, we need to either get a job that can pay more or we need to move. Mm-hmm. And so somebody approached me and said, hey, my husband works with this medical company. He's hiring outside sales people to sell like oxygen and nebulizers and nebulized medications, CPAP, all these medical supplies and stuff like that. So I thought, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a sales guy. It seems so slimy. Uh-huh. But we needed the money, and so I just decided to do it, and did really well at it. It just it took me a little while to hit my stride, but then I thought, man, I really enjoy this, like actually helping people and forming relationships with doctors and nurses and being available for them to help their patients, and it was just really rewarding.
Okay,
and so did that for. Ended up getting into management there with that company and ended up after 10 years being the VP of sales and marketing for the whole company nationwide.
Wow.
And so just like a skyrocket kind of a career, kind of a 20-year career in 10 years. And I failed a ton through that, but learned so much and it was so helpful for me.
During that time, did you build your family?
Yep. Son grew, had a daughter, and was traveling a lot. You know, at the end there, it was just, you know, 4 days a week, probably. I was gone, flying all over the country, meetings and conferences and all that kind of stuff. And so it was getting to the point where they wanted all the VPs up in San Francisco, where the company was based. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to move because, you know, your kids are young and they're getting into school and they're getting established with their friends. And so long story short, we just decided like, hey, let's, I think it's time to call it quits. Didn't really know what was next, except I felt like the Lord was calling me into ministry. But I didn't know. We were at New Life then at the time, mm-hmm. and got a 3-month severance from the medical company. So felt like, okay, we got a little bit of a buffer, but not much. And I had this book idea that I really wanted to work on. And I was telling Jen, I think I really need to write this book. And she's like, I think you really need to get a job. so that was tough, but it was like the only time in my life where I can remember, if I don't do this, I won't be able to live with myself. Okay. It's just like this just fire in my gut for this mm-hmm. book. And I just had to do it. And so, mm-hmm. but part of that was like, I wanted to be around for the kids, you know, where I was gone and missed so much. And I wanted to just be home for a while. And so started working part-time at New Life at that time. The previous worship director had gone to be a senior pastor at another church. Mm-hmm. So there was an opportunity, and Pastor Ron asked me and a few other guys, can you just keep the wheels on the bus mm-hmm. and help us through this time? So I was trying to write the book and kind of do that simultaneously.
So when did the book come out?
It was like three years ago.
So in so many words, explain to me the thesis and the conclusion of it. I've read it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Thanks.
And I suggest everybody go get it. It's at the Parable. It's a great book.
Thanks.
It really is.
Thank you. Yeah. It's called Pink Flamingo, Regaining Our Purpose in a Plastic World. And the idea actually came out, I'd kind of been asking this question about like what actually makes us different as Christians, you know, relative to everyone else in the world. Like, why are we different? You know, and in Peter, it's like you're a royal priesthood, holy nation. It's like, I don't feel like that most days. I feel just like trying to get through the day.
Slob.
A normal slob, exactly. Yeah, right. You know, and so I tell the story in the book, but we were at a dinner party with some friends, and they were all non-believers. And so we were just like, you know, the kids are busy. You're just trying to like power as much appetizers as you possibly can while the kids are like, you know, distracted. So we were like eating and just sharing, like getting updates on what's going on in each other's lives. And, you know, one couple was like using proceeds from their local business to help youth sports programs. Like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. Another was, you know, adopting a kid. And they got to us and it's like, they're not doing anything. So these like non-Christians are better Christians than I am. And so that really messed me up. And I was just thinking like, it has to be more than morality. These people are more patient, more kind, more loving. It's not, so it's like, it is being a moral person, morally good, but it's got to be more than that because they win at mm-hmm. almost every step. And so the book was not that I had the answer. The book was me trying to figure out the answer. And so the three big ideas that I go through in the book is that, you know, it starts with like the lordship of Christ. You have to decide like he's calling the shots and you're not. Mm-hmm. And the second is the empowerment of the Holy Spirit. And the third is that your gifts and graces are being displayed in and through your community. And I think when all three of those are in play, I think you are set apart. And you are that holy nation, royal priesthood. And really like the Lord can usher in his kingdom through your life if those three things are in place.
So how now do you push that? Or how do you make ripples in the community? Making those three points, how do you live as if you're a royal priest?
Yeah, I think for me, it's been trying to have these conversations with the church. I just feel like that's kind of like my, I don't know, calling's a really strong word, mm-hmm. but that's a thing where I feel like kind of my passions and skill sets and the world's kind of need, that's where those things kind of overlap. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's like, obviously in the career that I'm in, trying to be helpful and honest and those kinds of things and be a good person in the community, all that kind of stuff. But like really trying to figure out for myself and then help other people understand, like, how do you actually live different? And so it's like, I taught a class on rule of life last year. It's like, how do you actually, because you're being shaped in by the world and the culture in subtle and subversive ways all day, every day. And so if you want to be made in the image of Christ, like you need a counter-formational force that's greater than the force being exerted on you by culture if you're going to be shaped in the way of Christ. Otherwise, you're just going to slide into the culture and the way
it's
of the
easy.
World. It's just like, it's just everywhere.
It's automatic.
It's automatic. And so you need this counterformational force. And so how do you organize your life and the mundane monotony of your life? Like, how do you organize that to be shaped into Christ-likeness? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like for me, it's like really trying to help people figure that out. And so whether it's a rule of life class, developing discipleship materials, helping my son who's, you know, just in his teenage years, like start on that path now. I think that's how I'm trying to create a ripple effect in the world, is through my family, through my local church, and trying to figure out how to help people along that way.
So I want to get back to your progression in your career and where you're at now.
Yeah.
But just as we're talking about this counter-formational forces.
Yeah.
The culture, what do you see, what, like, top five things that you see putting your finger in the wind as a Christian that we have to combat intentionally to make sure we're meeting that mandate as a royal priesthood?
Yeah, I mean, I might get this data a little bit off, but, you know, there's something like 19% of adults having symptoms of anxiety or depression, and 40% of our youth. It's rampant. Like, suicide is... it like surpassed homicides in like 2020. It's like the second leading cause of death. It's just like you look around at the stats and it just is not pretty. And so, you know, I had the chance to actually go back to my last week. I went back to Coalinga and spoke to the graduating class of 2022. And it was so surreal, you know, 23 years later, mm-hmm. being back in that room and being able to talk to them and like trying to figure out what do I say to a bunch of 17-year-olds? Like, what would have moved the needle for me? And the question I asked them is, what do you want? Like, what do you actually want? Because like I shared the data, like this is what the world is producing. It's not like the world's evil going to hell in a handbasket. I think the Lord is actually redeeming and restoring his world and we can join him in that. So it's not like a hellfire and brimstone, but it's like, it's a counterformative way. It's a narrow road. And like very few will choose this because you have to die. You know, it's like pick up your cross, deny yourself, and that's the way to life. And it's so counterintuitive. And so just sharing this and saying like, this is what will happen. Like no one wakes up in the morning and decides like, you know what I want? I want to be totally just average. I want to fly under the radar. I hope if I get married, I don't want my wife to love me passionately and unconditionally. Mm-hmm. I want my wife to tolerate me. And if I have kids, I want to mess them up so badly that they'll need therapy for the rest of their lives. And if I have a job, I really hope I despise it, but I work 60 hours a week and do it for 50 years and have nothing to show for it at the end of the day. Like no one says that, but that's the reality for most people. And so is that what you want? Because entropy is the natural way of things. So that's what will happen. Unless you form your life differently and have that counterformational force and develop different rhythms and patterns that combat what the world will naturally have happen to you.
So what rhythms are those that would be helpful for all of us and in particular, maybe a younger person?
Yeah, I think it's different for everybody. And that's where doing things like, you know, Enneagram, Strength Finders, and figuring out how has God wired you? Like there's only one of you. Like there will never be anyone like Mike Pick ever again in the history of the world. Thank God, right?
I know. my family's happy.
I know.
Yeah.
But like there will never be anyone like you ever again in the history of the world. There has never been anyone like you. So you have a unique opportunity to do what only you can do and to join in this kingdom partnership with the Lord in like amazing ways. And so it's like, don't waste your life, but you're unique. And I think our passions and the way we're wired are unique. And so that's where taking stuff like Enneagram and Strength Finders helps you understand who you are. And then doing something like Rule of Life. It's like you have 24 hours in a day and you're gonna fill it with stuff. And I think the reality is, and what we found through teaching this class is you actually have more discretionary time than you think you do if you actually put it down on paper. Mm-hmm. And so what are some healthy rhythms and habits? For example, for me, and this isn't for everybody, but for me, I like to wake up about 5:30, spend 10 minutes just in silence. Try not to think about anything, try not to look at my, because for most people, the last thing you look at before you go to bed and the first thing you look at when you wake up is your phone. Mm-hmm. And that shapes you. Mm-hmm. And I think negatively. So spend
agreed.
So spend some time in silence. And then
coffee's brewing.
Yes. Coffee first, then okay, silence, right. Priorities.
Okay.
And then, you know, I'll do, for example, there's a great app called Lectio 365. And it's an ancient practice, Lectio Divina, of reading and engaging with the scripture. But literally, you can just, they have a new one every morning. You download the app, you hit play, and it's about 8 minutes long, and you just meditate on scripture and God's word. And that's a great way. And then I'll open the Bible and I'll do whatever reading plan I'm in. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go through and I'll write three things I'm grateful for. I'll write out kind of like, here's what my top three things for the day, to-do list. And it gets more tactical.
Sure.
But, you know, if you take like 30 minutes, well, and then I spend about 30 minutes with my son mm-hmm. on some discipleship stuff that I'm working on with him. But I need that first hour to prep my own heart and mind for the day. And I find that if I, and I'm not as consistent as I want to be in that, but when I do that, I just find that like, I'm just better off the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. And so spending that hour or whatever it is, like not everyone has that time. If you have five, just start somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest advice. Just start somewhere. You don't need to be perfect, but like, just take one step forward and then build on it over time. And that just, I find, shapes me as that counterformational force in my own life.
So Enneagram and StrengthFinders, talk a little bit about that for some of the people may not be familiar with those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, StrengthFinders is a good tool made by Gallup. And you could buy the book, you could just pay for the test online. It basically gives you, you know, the cheaper version gives you like your top five strengths. And so it's like, you'll find this like minor, you know, it's ideation, input, connectedness, achievement, and strategy. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that, and I think for a lot of people, what it does is it gives you language for something you might already know about yourself. Gosh, I like love ideas. I'm constantly writing down ideas. What's my number one strength? Of course I am. That's how God made me.
Right.
but then to be able to like, to input, like I read, I listen to podcasts, constantly consuming stuff, mm-hmm. and that feeds the ideation. But then like connecting it to something and in a strategic way in order to achieve something. So that's kind of, that just gave me language for it. And Enneagram largely is, you know, I'm an Enneagram 9 peacemaker. And it helps in terms of relationships and just understanding how my brain works. And really when I'm healthy, like, cause you know, it gives you all of this kind of stuff when you're healthy to when you're unhealthy and what it looks like. And I'm like, well, when I do that thing, like that passive aggressive thing, I'm not healthy. Mm-hmm. And so just again, like language. And then also there's some great resources for spiritual practices relative to your Enneagram number. Mm-hmm. So it's like upstream practices. These things like for Enneagram 9s are going to be difficult, but you should do some of them. And the downstream practices for an Enneagram 9 or whatever are going to be more easy, and you should do those. And so you have some balance. So I think knowing about yourself will help you, will help guide you to some of these spiritual practices that are counterformative into the way of Christ.
Based on that self-examination, what age would you recommend someone taking these tests and kind of forming
I don't know. I think there's probably stuff for like teenagers, but about that time, I mean, part of it's like your frontal lobe isn't even developed.
Right, until 25, right? Or whatever. Or think, 45.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I'm waiting. Yeah. I'm still waiting.
It's going to happen.
Late bloomer. Right. But I'm thinking for my son, he's 15. Like mm-hmm. I would love him to do something like an Enneagram. If nothing else, even if it's wrong, just to have the discussion with him and have him start thinking about like, mm-hmm. you know, being self-aware, which I don't think is like intuitive or natural mm-hmm. for, you know, especially 15-year-old boys or any young person really. But I think probably about now for him, I want to start getting him thinking about that and just help guide him.
So you walk away from a very successful career. You write your book mm-hmm. and then you dive into...
Yeah, full-time ministry.
Right.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I spent the next 5 years in full-time ministry. And, you know, it was funny because when I was writing the book, I didn't know what was next really with ministry. I just knew God was calling me to the church. And I was leading, I got hired on full-time to be like the worship arts and communications director at the church. And, you know, and then it just... pandemic and all that stuff. Surprise. Pastor Ron died, and we're like spend the next year or two trying to find a replacement and onboard David, who's incredible. And just so that was the first few years, and then the pandemic happened, and that was like the last two or three years. So it was like a chaotic time, but it was really neat to be able to serve the church in some small way during that time. And I learned before I started, I was looking around at people who were doing what I thought I wanted to do, writing, speaking, that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. teaching, podcasting, all that kind of stuff. And they were all lead pastors, but it took me all of 2 weeks to realize I don't want to be a lead pastor. That is mm-hmm. not for me. It's not what I want to do. God bless them. It wasn't for me. So then it was kind of a question of, well, what then next? And so I feel like for the last 5 years, it was just kind of like you're just treading water given everything that was happening. I didn't really have much time to think about it. But kind of feeling like I loved what I was doing and I loved contributing, but never felt like I was really hitting my stride. Never really felt like I was doing the thing I wanted to do. Working at a church is—it's hard. It's tough for so many reasons. And so, just feeling like the pull to get back into sales and business, but also feeling like I was still called to the church, but I just didn't have to work at a church to be called to the church because we are a royal priesthood, all of us, and so a holy nation. And so, we all have these gifts and graces, and we can and should help people figure out how to use them in whatever vocation it is. And so, transitioning out of full-time ministry into business again over the last few months has offered me an opportunity to try to sort all that out again.
So now, with all this rich background, going back into the marketplace as a minister and a royal priest, what things are you intentionally focusing on as you enter that marketplace and how you conduct your business, your communications, et cetera? How do you be that difference maker now in that place?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still trying to figure it out, to be honest with you, but I think part of it is, I'll give you some examples. So I'm in real estate now. And so just trying to have a ton of integrity and be super honest and really add value for people. So that's part of it that I think like kind of everyone would want to do, right? That's the goal. And then
hopefully
I hope. But everyone's trying to do that. So that's just kind of like, let's call that baseline.
Sure.
And then trying to, with my team and our clients, just trying to continue to have conversations. Like we'll ask to pray for, when we write up an offer for somebody, we'll just ask them, hey, can we pray for you? And sometimes they'll say like, oh my gosh, you guys are believers. That's amazing. So are we. Or sometimes they'll say, I guess, sure. It's right. Really awkward. Yeah. Uh-huh. But you know, you just try to invite the Holy Spirit into that situation. When I do walkthroughs, like when we are in contract on a home, whoever it is, I hope they don't mind this, but I go through every room as I'm making notes on like the stuff I need to look for. I pray through the house. Mm-hmm. You know, me and my coworkers on the team, we are constantly asking ourselves, how's your heart? How are you doing? Do you need time with your family? Like, are you overworking? And just try to like keep that accountability going. We're starting a Bible study at our office, me and one of the guys on the team. So we're just going to co-lead a Bible study for whoever. Mm-hmm. And hopefully a lot of people who are just skeptical or just not sure about the Bible can come, and we'll just open it up and see what the Lord does with it. So I think just little things like that, it doesn't need to be mind blowing or anything, but just like just praying, well, Lord, what do you want me to do? I think the Lord will answer. And then I think so much of it is just about when he will tell you, and it's more a matter of like, will you be obedient or not?
That's pretty impressive. So one thing that is, we're sitting here and I've gotten to know you, is just your intentionality and your examination, your self-examination of improving yourself and your walk with the Lord and your community and your family. One thing that's difficult when you do that kind of self-examination is finding those blind spots or those defects that are maybe glaring. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that, or how do you kind of challenge that in yourself when you determine that, hey, this is not, my nine is like acting out. Yeah. How do I do that? What kind of wisdom can you share about that?
Yeah, I think for everyone kind of thinks, well, gosh, if my spouse or my coworker or Mike would just think the way I think, everything would be better. Because like, obviously I have like a corner on the market, but you don't, you know? And so I think just constantly asking like, okay, where is my blind spot? When you identify them, I mean, I have the same stuff pop up. Like I should be further along than I am on some of these blind spots, but they're just so difficult to combat. Like, one of the biggest ones that nines deal with is conflict avoidance, you know? And so I think having that career in business forced me to have conflict, and I wouldn't have otherwise grown so much. I still struggle with it, but it was just like just thrown in the deep end of that. Like, you have to deal with this stuff. And even in my relationship, so I've gotten better, but still in my relationship with my wife, sometimes I'll, you know, something will come up and I'll feel like I need to talk about it, but I won't. and I'll do that passive aggressive thing and she'll be like, well, that's wrong. And then she'll pull it out of me and then I'll finally talk about it. And so I think just being intentional about like when something bothers me, just talk about it. And it's almost always better. It's like such a stupid little thing, but that for me is like, just take conflict head on and just deal with it.
Sure.
And, it's just almost always better, but I just have to, cause I'll just think like, it's not worth it. It's not worth whatever, you know, I don't know, whatever it'll cause, whatever kind of conflict it'll cause, but I just need to deal with it.
So sitting here, there's just kind of one thing I just kind of think about you as, and it's the term Renaissance man.
Uh-oh.
And no, this is a compliment. So, you know, that it's kind of maybe a little corny, but these Renaissance men of earlier ages were, you know, deep in faith or science or music and arts, and they just kind of had their hand in everything, which I think is kind of a projection of your faith in God, because God is everything and everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking back on someone that's musically inclined or artistically inclined or a nine or something, you know, looking back at maybe your 15-year-old son or your daughter, what kind of advice would you give them early on to avoid that waking up with the puke on your shirt moment and then having to go to crew to reintroduce yourself to God?
Yeah. One thing my dad told me when I was, I think, about to graduate high school, because he got a job out of high school and just did it because it was a thing to do. And he never really enjoyed it, but it provided well for the family. But he just said, whatever you do, do something you love. And so I kind of carried that with me. And I know what he meant, and it was good advice. But I think for people who are artistically minded and creative, all you can see is like, well, if my passion isn't my career, then I've failed, you know, and I've failed at everything. Like music failed. I wrote a book and I'm not out there speaking and writing. I didn't fail. I'm being a little dramatic, but you know what I mean? Like I didn't make it my career. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's actually fine. I mean, at least I'm coming to terms with it. And so I think so many creative people, it's like, this is who I am as a person. This is my identity. And if I don't do this, I'm a failure. And you wrap your identity and worth in this thing that this ability or
productivity or something.
This thing, this ability that God gave you, instead of him. Mm-hmm. And so I think that can be like a slippery slope. And so it's like, this is a tool that God gave me. Like he made you to be a certain way. Mm-hmm. And he made me to be a certain way, but to think like, well, if I don't do this with it, whether it's records sold or books sold or the size of the platform I speak on, it just gets really slippery really quickly. And then you just beat yourself up over it. And so Jen asked me before I went into real estate, she said, well, I mean, if we had all the money in the world, what would you do? And I was like, well, I love music. I don't know that I'd want to do music full time. Mm-hmm. I love writing, but I don't think I want to necessarily be an author. And then I love speaking, but I don't know that I want to travel everywhere and speak. Mm-hmm. Not that I even have the opportunity to do any of these things, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I just realized, man, I'm in this amazing position to now to be able to do something that provides my family and then do everything else I want to do. Mm-hmm. Like I'm still leading worship at the church. I'm still speaking. I'm still teaching class. Like I'm doing everything I want to do. I just don't have to do it, you know, as a career. And there's so much freedom actually in that. And so I think looking back on my high school self, it's like, be okay with the monotony and mundane of life, because that's where you're shaped and formed. And that's where most of your life is lived. So many of us, like you get a few mountaintop moments, but those are few and far in between. And so if you're not comfortable with the monotony of your life and actually content and happy, but content with it, mm-hmm. I think you're going to set yourself up for failure. And so I don't know how you convince a 17-year-old of that, but right. I think maybe it takes being 40 now and realizing like, oh man, life can be really beautiful if you're content with and you shape and build your life and these like these rhythms and patterns that I think shape you in really healthy ways that produce the fruit of the Spirit versus whatever fruit the world's wanting to produce.
So, you know, one thing is we're talking here, your rhythms and practices and your disciplines. How do you get your family to buy in? How do you lead your family?
Yeah, man, it's so hard. I feel like, you know, part of it is I'm just trying to figure it out for myself. You know, it's like I feel like I don't have it all figured out. And so how can you invite your family into something that you're not doing? And so I think that's kind of like the devil kind of chirping in your ear a little bit, like, which I think is just a lie. You don't have to have it all figured out before you invite your family into it. It's like, hey, let's just figure this out together. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I tried to get my family to put our cell phones in a drawer for a whole day. And that didn't.
No who one, broke the? Who no, broke it first?
We didn't even start. It never even started. Yeah. Right. But it's just hard. It's like, okay, well, we have screen time and all that kind of stuff, and it's like, you know. But one thing that we've been decent at is just the idea of Sabbath, which you know very mm-hmm. well. And so, one thing that's been fun for the family, like my kids are 15 and 11, and my 15-year-old doesn't care about it as much as the 11-year-old. But on Saturday at 6 p.m., we light a candle. And we remind each other about like the presence of God, you know, in the house. And I think just, you know, my daughter asked like, hey, what time do we light the candle again? I was like, oh, 3 hours ago, I'm late. Yeah. But like we lit it and it's just like that visual, it's a tradition and it's mm-hmm. a rhythm. I think that's one, just it's a simple way. But I think those are the kinds of things that will shape them and they'll remember when they're older and maybe like continue those traditions in their own family. But they'll remember, hey, we did this as a family and it was formative and this is what it meant. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part. It's not just doing it, but reiterating this is why we do it and this is why it matters. It's not just some rote thing that we do because we do it.
There's purpose.
There's purpose behind it and it's meaningful. And so, you know, like, with my son, it's 6:30 every morning. We'll like try to have a conversation or read a scripture. And it's like pulling teeth, you know, trying to get him to engage. And most of the time he just doesn't. Mm-hmm. But he's going to remember that every day at 6:30, my dad came in my room and I hated him for it. But I really loved it. And it was, I hope, is the goal. But, you know, those kinds of things, just reminding on like a Sabbath, hey, we're not going to buy anything. We're going to actually like, we're not going to go the way of the world. We are going to pleasure stack, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that's a really fun thing where it's like Sabbath can be so much about what we're not going to do or what we're going to stop doing. Right. But I think
it's a holiday though.
It's a holiday. Right. So it's like, let's pleasure stack, man. Let's mm-hmm. like, let's make a huge feast. Mm-hmm. Let's invite friends or family over. If you're married, do married couple stuff, you know, it's just like do all of those things and just celebrate everything good that the Lord has given you. I think
it's a
that's
mitzvah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think just like when kids see like, hey, we're going to eat a pint of ice cream. They love that, but they know that it's, hey, Sabbath is something to look forward to.
It's great.
And so it's hard to do that, I think, with some of these things, but I'm trying to figure out how to make it meaningful for them and fun and something they look forward to, which won't be everything, but some of it, I hope.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Travis, it's been wonderful getting to know you. And thank you for opening your heart and opening your mind, more importantly, to sharing all this great stuff you've done. We have a tradition on The Drop, as you know, because you started it. And so our metaphor is dropping pennies in a jar. So metaphorically, as you've done, can you please drop some wisdom into our jar?
Love to.
Thank you, Travis.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. You too.